versus James Robinson, Jr., and we're very pleased to have with us, sitting by assignment, the Honorable Carol A. Corrigan, Associate Justice of the First Appellate District, Division 3, sitting by assignment as a Justice Pro Tem of our court. We'll hear first from Ms. Marr, Counsel for Appellate.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Susan Marr, and I'm the attorney here on behalf of Mr. James Robinson, who is the appellant in this case. As the court knows, this is a capital case in which my client was convicted in 1993 of two counts of capital murder with special circumstances of robbery and burglary, found true. The case proceeded to guilt verdict, then a penalty phase was held. The jury deadlocked after several days of deliberations. The court declared a mistrial and reset the case for impanel a new jury and proceed to penalty. In the intervening time, trial counsel for the defense had to declare a conflict, new counsel had to be located, and we finally proceeded to the penalty phase in this case approximately a year later in the spring of 1994. As the court knows, the briefing in this case, as they often are, is very extensive. We've raised a number of contentions on appeal. Respondent has raised substantial issues. Today, before the court, I would like to address two issues, and primarily the jury selection issues, which are their argument two in the appellant's opening brief. There are many, many errors in the voir dire process in this case, and it's particularly interesting to be before the court to argue because in the intervening 2 years since the submission of all of the briefing in Mr. Robinson's case, this court has embarked upon a number of opinions on jury selection.
Without in any way restricting your focus on those two jury selection issues, I do want you to make sure that you leave some time in your argument to deal with the victim impact evidence question as well, which is one of interest to the court.
Be happy to, Your Honor. Thank you. The jury selection issues in this case are really, frankly, the facts present a more extreme case in terms of the degree of error and the number of errors than any of the recent opinions that appellant has seen in preparing for this argument. It's particularly interesting at this time because not only this court, but the United States Supreme Court have issued some decisions discussing the range of discretion the trial court has in voir dire issues, although some of the recent Supreme Court, just U.S. Supreme Court cases have been slightly different, dealing with Batson and Wheeler challenges. Here, James Robinson has argued that the voir dire process was deficient in a number of aspects, and the errors fall into three basic categories. First, that the voir dire was wholly inadequate to determine challenges for cause because the trial court's methods of voir dire failed to extract sufficient meaningful information from the prospective jurors. Therefore, neither counsel nor the court had adequate information on which to base a challenge for cause. There were a few reasons for the inadequacy. First of all, the court relied upon a very extensive juror questionnaire. And appellant's mindful of the fact that this court has said in a number of circumstances that juror questionnaires, particularly in capital cases, are very beneficial. They can provide a lot of information and certainly save the court and the attorneys and all the parties a lot of time. However, the circumstances surrounding this court's questionnaire and the way that the court administered the questionnaire seriously call into doubt the accuracy of the information there obtained. As we've discussed in the briefing, and also as defense counsel pointed out at trial, the court gave this questionnaire to the jurors, and most of them had less than 45 minutes to an hour, maybe, to fill it out.
How long was the questionnaire? Was that a 20-page questionnaire that each of the prospective jurors had to fill out? And did it have roughly 56 questions that required answers of the prospective jurors?
Yes, Your Honor, it did. It's approximately 24 pages, and I would venture a guess, although I do not know that precisely that this is the same questionnaire that the same trial court, that this court considered some challenges to the voir dire in People v. Roldan within the last couple of years.
Now, what degree of input or opportunity for input was there into the formulation of the questionnaire on behalf of the prosecution and the defense?
The record is not crystal clear in this area. However, the court once, I believe at least, in advance, in pretrial hearings, in advance of both jury selections, said in the course of discussing with counsel whether they would be allowed any voir dire, which counsel requested in both instances, the court said, well, I plan to do the questioning because that's my reading of the statute, and that's how I, as a trial judge, intend to exercise my discretion. However, if you have any questions or particular areas you want to ask about, submit it, and I'll take it into consideration. So they did have that opportunity. However, you know, again, based on subsequent events, it does not seem that that was sufficient. By the time the juror questionnaires were returned, completed by the prospective jurors, defense counsel had already filed a motion for voir dire by the attorneys, which the prosecutor joined. They were concerned even at that time that there were some additional areas, primarily racial prejudice and exposure to publicity, that needed further inquiry.
Well, was there any indication of an objection by the defense to the format or wording of the questionnaire or any improper restriction on defense counsel's ability to supplement that questionnaire with oral examination by counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to the questionnaire itself, counsel did raise an objection, albeit subsequently to the jurors completing the questionnaire, about the sufficiency of the question concerning attitudes about race. And that was based under Turner v. Murray. The court clearly at that time could not go back and rewrite that question, but declined also to inquire further at all of the jurors. The question, which this court has criticized or indicated, I believe, was not a model of clarity, is question number 47, and it simply asked the jurors if they would have problems giving equal credibility or equal weight to the testimony of a person from a different race or a different background. I apologize if I'm incorrectly paraphrasing that. But
as I understand it, the court initially offered both counsel the opportunity to modify, to suggest any modifications to the questionnaire, and the record indicates that neither side requested any modifications. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I believe that is correct. However, our position would be that our challenge is less concerning the phrasing of the questionnaire itself. On its own, standing alone, the questionnaire isn't a terrible questionnaire. However, under the circumstances that it was administered, where the people didn't have anywhere near enough time to complete it, and the court's basically refusal to follow up on the questions asked in the questionnaire, it didn't achieve its purpose. Another interesting fact that I...
Well, before you get into the other interesting fact, getting back to your response to Justice Chin's question, where you, in the course of your answer, pointed out that, well, the prospective jurors didn't have ample time, that's where my inquiry is directed to. The record shows that the entire process took 3 hours and 20 minutes, and your claim of error is that this time was simply woefully inadequate for any prospective juror to answer the questions?
Your Honor, the 199 minutes that the court spent on the oral voir dire is somewhat separate from the March 30th date and then the subsequent date with the second jury, where the jurors came into court, were given the questionnaire, and were told by the trial court, you need to turn this in by 12 o'clock noon or else wait till 1:30 at the latest when the court returns from lunch. The court will be dark between 12 and 1:30. The court basically strongly encouraged these people, get it done between 11:30 or 12, and it was after 11 o'clock or thereabouts when the court made that announcement. The jurors had walked into the courtroom. These people don't know if they're here to hear any whatever kind of case. they are given a very brief introduction to the case, a little bit, told a little bit about what hardship excusal might be, where they might or might not have a hardship, and then told, you know, all right, go outside, find a pen, and fill out this questionnaire. The other thing, and the court also said about three times, certainly with the first jury, we will follow this up. This is not the time. Today, we're going to talk about hardship. This isn't the time in this process that we're going to talk about your attitudes toward the death penalty. Although, you know, I as a lawyer in the court, and as we read precisely what the court says, the court is correct. The overall impression, it seems to me, creates with the jurors is that, and also, I apologize, also with some extra language that is on the cover sheet of the questionnaire, it gives the impression that fill this out, get it turned in, you'll have an opportunity, we'll have an opportunity to follow up with you to clarify these things.
Do you dispute the trial court's characterization of the jury questionnaire responses as fully completed, that some could be done with only a few words, that many involved things that were inapplicable, and that there were many thoughtful written answers to various open-ended questions? The trial court made that observation. Do you dispute that?
Frankly, Your Honor, yes, we do dispute that. There are, in the briefing, there's a breakdown of exactly how many blank questionnaire answers the trial court had to go back and try to clarify.
But a lot of those were inapplicable, weren't they? And then there was the opportunity to supplement it with oral or dire.
Some of them were inapplicable. Others of them, it appeared the juror didn't understand the questionnaire or ran out of time or in a variety of problems. However, the oral voir dire was not effective. Counsel did, in contrast to a lot of the cases that this court has decided in the intervening 2 years, counsel did not have an opportunity for oral voir dire. The motion by the prosecutor and defense counsel to be allowed even minimal, slight voir dire on the jurors was denied. Counsel specifically requested voir dire on a few jurors where they had identified what they believed to be biases or problems from the questionnaire, largely denied. And the court, in its own voir dire, was very, very cursory. The basic approach of the court was to say to the juror who has filled out the questionnaire 5 days earlier and does not have it before them. The court has a hold of all these questionnaires, and the court would say, I have your questionnaire here, Mr. Prospective Juror. Is there anything you'd like to change? By and large, they said no. It was only one or two people who said, I can't remember, or I don't think so, or perhaps. And at that point, if the juror had no answers to change or couldn't remember any answers that they wanted to change or modify, the court proceeded to the four death-qualifying questions from, you know, Wainwright and Witt and Witherspoon. And if there were, you know, and that was it. Unless the court had identified some particular question in the questionnaire that it was concerned about, and that happened very rarely, only in a handful of cases.
Counsel, if I might just clarify for myself, you are concerned with the voir dire both in the guilt phase and the penalty phase. At this moment, are we talking about the guilt phase jury?
Yes, Your Honor.
We are. Go ahead.
Although at the time that jury was being selected, it was presumed to be the guilt and penalty phase jury.
And have you told us, apart from the fact that you feel the voir dire was inadequate, have you told us in what areas you believe it prejudiced your client? Have I heard that this morning and missed it? Or
possibly not, Your Honor. I apologize. The voir dire was particularly inadequate in the area of attitudes toward race. The United States Supreme Court had already, by 1986, clearly held in Turner v. Murray that a capital defendant has a right to have the jury informed that the victims and the defendant are of different races.
What questions respecting race were posed to the prospective jurors?
Only the questionnaire, question number 47, which I have here and could read to the court. It is, a party or attorneys or witnesses may come from a particular national, racial, or religious group or has a lifestyle different from your own, would that fact affect your judgment or the weight and credibility you would give to his or her testimony? And there's a space to explain. We had, that I recall, one occasion on which a juror wrote, you know, answered that question, you know, in what the court deemed to be inappropriately, said yes, possibly it would. And the court, you know, did a minimal follow-up, and that is the questioning is set forth in the briefing at prospective juror Thompson. However, the court refused counsel's request to even advise the jurors before beginning oral voir dire. They could see that my client, Mr. Robinson, is African-American, but the trial court was specifically asked to inform the jurors or the prospective jurors that the victims were white, and the court did not do so, declined to do so, and did no further follow-up on any racial questions. And this question, on its terms, does not ask the jurors would they be biased given the race of the defendant.
Now, to revisit some territory you've touched on earlier, did defense counsel have the opportunity to ask the court to further explore the issue of racial prejudice? Could they have posed additional questions for the court's consideration?
At that time, the court made it fairly clear that it wasn't going to consider it. The court did say, if you have a concern with respect to a particular juror, you know, yes. But in every instance that came up, that situation arose, the court declined to follow up at defense request on every occasion.
You're saying that when the court offered additional questions on a juror-by-juror basis individually as they come up, the defense counsel asked to take the court up on that offer? My reading of the record is that the defense counsel did not follow up on that case-by-case offer.
Counsel was invited to suggest to the court additional questions which the court might pose. Counsel was never invited to pose any questions to the jurors themselves.
But to follow up on this point, did counsel submit to the court questions respecting racial bias or prejudice?
Other than calling to the attention of the court the need to voir dire in this general area or at least to inform the jurors, no. Not that I'm aware.
Doesn't that pose an obstacle to the argument that you're making here, along with our general observation in the 1998 case of People versus Dennis, that the failure to exhaust peremptory challenges available is a strong indication that the jurors were fair and that the defense so indicated? And I believe here that although the law entitled the defense to 20 peremptory challenges, the defense sought to exercise only 14 of those 20. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that is the correct statement of the record. However, as Your Honor's own opinion in People v. Heard makes clear, and also the People v. Stewart case, it is not really feasible to ask the defense to exercise peremptory challenges meaningfully where they don't have enough information to do so. Here the problem was a lack of information. The questions haven't been put to the jurors in the questionnaire or subsequently on oral voir dire, whether about their racial attitudes or a whole host of other areas. So therefore, counsel had no basis to exercise peremptories against.
But you just told Justice Werdegar in response to her question that there were no questions submitted by defense counsel to the trial court.
That's correct. The defense counsel stopped short at asking the trial court or pointing out for the trial court that that these areas were not covered adequately in the questionnaire and indicating that the trial court should itself probe these areas more extensively in the oral voir dire or allow counsel to do so.
So is it your position that given your view of this as inadequate, we then should conclude that defendant was denied a constitutional right that requires us to reverse the finding of guilt? Is that where we're going with this?
Your Honor, that's what we've argued in the briefing. We're certainly mindful of the fact that that was the position of Justice Brennan in the United States Supreme Court in dissent, that inadequate voir dire on race and possible racial bias could be just as devastating to a capital defendant in the guilt phase as in the penalty phase. The majority of the Supreme Court did not agree, and Turner is limited to the penalty phase, given the increased range of discretion.
Where does that leave us if we were to follow the United States Supreme Court precedent? Where does it leave you, your position on this issue?
Where I think we can distinguish the cases is, again, back to the inadequacy of the voir dire in this case, where we've asked and specifically requested more information, please explore these attitudes with these jurors, and that request was denied. Again, you know, it makes it very, very difficult for defense counsel or the prosecutor to identify bias or possible areas to further explore if the initial questioning is not significant enough to allow the jurors to answer those questions. In addition to the way in which the form was administered and the lack of voir dire, we claim the inappropriate lack of voir dire or follow-up by the court in the areas of race and publicity. Another disturbing aspect of this case is where the defense counsel did identify in several instances jurors who had attitudes, I believe three in the first trial and three in the second, which were troubling, which indicated that they might be impaired in considering mitigation evidence in all the penalty phases or in following the law. Specifically, two jurors said, or actually four, said that they felt strongly about the death penalty and that it was a good idea because society should not be paying to house, you know, convicted criminals. Again, defense counsel pointed this out, and the trial court refused to do any further questions.
This is the first jury still, and they hung on the penalty.
However, even we had the same thing arise in the second jury.
So are we going to now talk about the second? I just want to make sure I'm following what I'm supposed to be considering.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. The second jury, as I said, was informed that there was a racial difference between the victims and the defendant. But once again, here the oral voir dire was even more truncated than it was in the first trial. The court completed all the oral voir dire of the jurors in 167 minutes, less than 2 minutes per juror. Again, in the majority of cases, including 11, I believe, of the 12 jurors who were seated on the case, they answered no further questions on voir dire after saying that they had no answer. They were not aware of any changes that they needed to make in their questionnaire, and they answered the court had narrowed to two death qualifying inquiries because the guilt phase had been decided. Here again, we also see, you know, the court is very much more proactive, as we've discussed in the briefing, with respect to jurors who appear to be not as likely to vote for a death penalty. The one occasion on which the court acceded to either counsel's request for more questioning on a juror was where the prosecutor pointed out to the trial court, Judge, this juror has said in her questionnaire that she would favor the death penalty only in cases of where there was an eyewitness or whether she herself saw the crime. And the court immediately did conduct further voir dire on that juror to be sure that she understood that that was not the standard. Conversely, when the jurors appear to be more death prone, for lack of a better term, the court would only stick to reiterating the questions, basically verbatim from the way it had them written in the questionnaire, confirming, you know, are you absolutely going to vote death in every case, or are you absolutely not going to vote death in any case, and left it at that.
Now, did counsel in this second jury voir dire and questioning about attitudes toward the death penalty. Did counsel have the opportunity to address the jurors and pose their own questions?
No, Your Honor. Again, it was requested and denied.
Ms. Marr, assuming that you don't have anything further to present on this issue, if you do, of course, you should proceed. But I just wanted to make sure that, as the Chief reminded you earlier, that you do get to the issue of victim impact evidence. And if you are ready to pursue that particular line in your argument, I do have a couple of questions in that regard. Are you ready to
get
into that area of inquiry?
Yes.
As we know, the United States Supreme Court back, I presume, was 1991 in its decision in Payne, allowed the admission at the penalty phase of a capital trial, admission of so-called victim impact evidence. And the court there pointed out its reasons for doing so. The court said that the state, of course, has an important interest in counteracting the mitigating evidence that the defendant naturally would present in persuading the jury not to impose the death penalty. And the High Court pointed out that from the standpoint of society, and especially the family of the murdered victim, there would be a very good reason and justification to allow the so-called victim impact evidence. Now, turning to the facts of this particular case, your client, according to the record and the evidence presented in that record, at one point was working at a Subway sandwich shop and eventually was let go or terminated by the owner of the sandwich shop after there were problems with cash missing, et cetera, et cetera. After your client's termination, at one point, one day, one night, whatever, he came back to the sandwich shop. There were these two teenage boys in the shop, and he killed them. We are now getting to the victim impact evidence. In this particular case, there was very lengthy testimony by the members of the families of both teenage victims as to the horrid impact that the death of their son in each family had on the members of the family. And you may recall that at one point, I think it was the father of victim Barry, and I hope I've got my facts right, in talking to the jury, talked about how he imagined the murder scene to have occurred, his son most likely pleading for his life, et cetera, et cetera. And I would like to hear from you, and then from your perspective, what problem do you have with this particular testimony? And, of course, later we'll hear from the Attorney General, but I would like to hear your position first.
With regard, just to clarify, Your Honor, with regard to all of the quantity of victim impact testimony or just...
Focusing on the example I gave. Okay. Initially, I said it was very lengthy testimony by both families. And at one point, the father, and I think it was the teenager, Barry, who had been killed by your client, talked to the jurors about how he, the father, imagined the murder scene to have occurred. Is there a problem with that, or what? I mean, I'd like to hear from you. Or am I focusing on something else that is not of concern to you? Is there something else that is of concern to you?
No, Your Honor, it definitely is of great concern, and for several reasons. And that specific portion of Mr. Barry's testimony is discussed in the briefing on a few bases. It's interesting to note that in the first penalty phase, because the case did go all the way to the penalty phase with the first jury, and they deadlocked in deliberations. Mr. Berry did not present that portion of his testimony is absent. That was a revision made for the second penalty phase, and if you lay the transcript side by side, the victims who testified in this case were, the victims' family members, rather, were reading prepared statements, were, you know, had planned their statements.
But what exactly do you find improper in this? Why shouldn't the father be allowed to tell the jurors, well, you know, undoubtedly this is what happened at the murder scene, my son pleading for his life, begging not to be shot? What, from your perspective, is improper?
The impropriety, or at least one of them, comes in connection with the fact that there really was no evidence of exactly what happened at the murder scene. There was certainly a lot of contradictory possible accounts. We've argued that the coroner in this case should not have testified. It was beyond his expertise, and he did not have a basis to testify as to the likely relative positions of the shooters and the victim. Mr. Berry's testimony was absolutely heart-wrenching, but again, the Supreme Court in Payne also said that we can't cross the line in terms of due process in the Eighth Amendment where the testimony becomes overwhelming and will induce undue prejudice, and this was a very, very poignant.
Is there California law that you think supports the particular argument that you are making, that this particular testimony should not have been admitted?
Your Honor, yes, I believe so. I would need a moment to consult the briefing on this.
Well, do you maintain that the trial judge was at fault for admitting that evidence?
Yes, we do
argue.
There
was no objection by defense counsel at trial, was there?
Your Honor, I would have to check as to what, I believe there was a motion to limit the victim impact testimony to some degree.
Our examination of the record seems to indicate that there was not sufficient objection or perhaps any objection within the requirements of 353 of the evidence code and of some of our capital jurisprudence. And if that's the case, in response to Justice Baxter's question, wouldn't that preclude a claim that the trial court erred in admitting this evidence?
Your Honor, I believe we've argued, and I would maintain that not necessarily, that the trial court here, in the penalty phase of a capital trial, the trial court has an obligation to be sure that the defendant's rights are protected and for society in general to be sure that the penalty of death is imposed on proper considerations and with some restrained discretion in the jury.
If there's no objection, is the trial court just supposed to jump in halfway through the poignant testimony of a victim's family member and say, well, you crossed the line now, you can't go on anymore?
Rather, I think one approach would be for the trial court to set some limits in advance.
Even without request by the defense?
Certainly would be far better practice for the defense to request it. However, again, we would maintain that the trial court does have a responsibility to the process and to ensuring that the penalty of death is not imposed for out of passion or prejudice.
Because I don't find this very poignant as it is to be much different from what the United States Supreme Court upheld in Payne, where a surviving young child who had been affected by the murders of both his mother and his sister committed in the child's presence was asked about the reaction, and apparently somebody testified that the child cries for his mother, doesn't seem to understand why she can't come home, cries for his sister, many times during the week comes to his grandmother and asks whether, you know, she misses the sister and so forth. I mean, that's rather poignant. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court put its imprimatur on that type of testimony, and your argument is that comparable testimony not objected to should be excluded by us.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with the court with regard to the comparability of those two examples. In Payne, there is a recitation. It's fairly brief by the grandmother to what the child experienced as a result. And the child was personally present and was almost killed himself in that case. Mr. Berry, as horrible as it was for him to imagine all of these things, was not present. And the testimony in his case was far more extensive, way more lengthy.
Great. Your time is up, assuming you wish to reserve your 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
All right. We'll hear now from Ms. Brody.
May it please the Court, Deputy Attorney General Anna Lee Brody on behalf of Respondent. And I'd like to respond, if I may, to the Court's inquiries about the victim impact evidence. And I'd like to remind the Court that although the evidence in this case was heartbreaking and is heartbreaking, that appellant murdered two young men who were members of very close families. And as these victims' families testified in the penalty phase, there were only four of them for the two victims, whereas appellant presented a parade of 13 witnesses who were there to talk about his good nature and his good character and that he was a church-going young man and that he was kind and gentle and nonviolent and that he deserved the jury's consideration of those attributes. And although the victim's family in this case gave poignant and heart-wrenching testimony, it was no different really than the evidence showed. The trial court did not abuse its discretion in allowing this evidence in, considering that the jury had already heard that appellant had executed these two young boys. The physical evidence at the scene showed how he shot them. A contact wound on the top of one boy's head as he, according to the coroner, knelt. And the jury had already considered this. We heard this kind of testimony from James Robinson's own mouth in his confessions. He bragged about the way he murdered these boys.
Ms. Brody, getting to the heart of the issue pertaining to victim impact evidence, because as you may have noticed, time goes by very fast and then sometimes there are questions that cannot be answered because the counsel has run out of time. And this is why I wanted to bring back to what I think may be the focus, or should be the focus, and I certainly can hear to the contrary, you know, later on. But here you may recall the question that I asked of Ms. Marr, opposing counsel. In the course of the family's testimony pertaining to the dreadful, horrible impact that the death of each teenager had on each family, I think the father of each murdered teenager imagined the crime scene that may have occurred and where, as they told the jurors, their particular son would have pleaded in vain to please spare his life. That aside, in People versus Pollock, a rather recent decision of this court said that characterizations or opinions about what might have occurred at a crime scene, this stuff, for lack of a better word, is inadmissible. Well, taking what we said in Pollock, taking a look at this particular case, here we do have the talk by the victim's respective fathers as to what may have occurred back at the crime scene. Isn't what occurred here improper under our decision in Pollock? And what is your answer?
I would say no, Your Honor, because victim impact evidence is meant to display for the jury the impact on the victim's family, in this case, psychic injury, not a recap.
Well, again, given what we said in Pollock, let's assume, of course, simply for the purposes of oral argument, that we disagree with you there. I presume the next step of the Attorney General would be, well, but as has been pointed out earlier, there was never any objection by the defense, and therefore, applying applicable law, this particular claim is forfeited.
Yes, Your Honor, that is true. There was no objection. This type of, assuming this was error, it could have easily been cured, prevented, had there been a timely objection. And I believe that it is waived for that reason.
We have substantial case authority in Pollock and one of the Brown cases, don't we, that there does not have to be any nexus with regard to victim impact testimony, limiting it to persons who were physically present as witnesses, as was the case of the victim's relative in pain, where the person was present. But that's not a requirement, and our decisions have made it clear that it's not a requirement, isn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor. It is not a requirement. Unless this court has any further questions on the victim impact area, I'd like to go back.
I have one further question. You mentioned earlier that here the victim impact evidence was appropriate. You compared it to the mitigation that was put on behalf of the defendant, where there were 13 witnesses. Are you proposing a rule that one can balance the other, so the more extensive the mitigating evidence, the more extensive the victim impact evidence? Are you suggesting there's a relationship between them?
I'm suggesting, Your Honor, that there is no bright line or no boundary right now for which, within which victim impact evidence must stay, or I believe it's dependent upon the circumstances of the case.
So in this case, if there had been less mitigating evidence, would you still be saying that the victim impact evidence, which was extraordinarily extensive, was all right?
Yes, I would, Your Honor.
So it's not related to the mitigating evidence then?
No, the fact that the appellant did put on so many witnesses to testify to his good nature and good character does not mean that the victims are required or that it's okay to match that number, you know, testimony per testimony, person per person. No, I believe it's more case-by-case basis. Of course, the trial court, it was within the trial court's discretion to exclude any evidence it deems as irrelevant. And all the evidence presented in this case on the victim's impact was properly presented in light of the nature of these crimes.
And is it relevant that the defense put on these 13 witnesses, totaling more than 100 pages of transcript, photographs of all sorts of things in mitigation, childhood experiences of the defendant, and so forth, that the defense put that on, and it was only thereafter, in an attempt to perhaps present the other side of the defendant's crimes or character, that the prosecution then introduced this challenged victim impact and victim character evidence.
It is relevant, Your Honors, for the jury to consider, that, and the jury is allowed to consider, the impact that the defendant's crimes had on the family involved. And the fact that appellant did put on so many witnesses, I think, helps in that if this court were determined that the victim impact and evidence in this case were erroneously allowed, then it certainly goes to whether the jury was affected or whether the error was harmless in this case. And I would submit that only four witnesses, immediate family witnesses, versus 13 from a large community, I would certainly mitigate any error.
Was this evidence presented in the first penalty trial, which ended in a hung jury?
There was much of this evidence was, Your Honor. There was much heartfelt.
So defense counsel could have anticipated this was going to come in again.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely.
And yet didn't object.
That's right. There was no objection, Your Honor.
And indeed, the first penalty phase did end in a jury that couldn't resolve the question of life or death.
That's correct. I'd like to turn briefly then to appellant's claims about jury selection in voir dire in this case. And I just would like to point out that the jury selection, the voir dire, the judge conducted voir dire in this case, was not only adequate but effective. It may have been short in time, but it was extremely thorough. The 24-page questionnaire was, if judging by their record, candidly, thoroughly filled out by each prospective juror, and the trial court took the time to question every juror who had listed either an ambiguous answer or a troublesome answer or even left an answer blank.
Could you address the voir dire with respect to racial prejudice, given the fact that there is a African-American defendant and the victims were white?
Yes, Your Honor. There was a question on both the penalty phase, the guilt phase and penalty phase questionnaire that we talked about, number 47, which informed the jurors that there may be victims or parties or witnesses of different races.
It did say that.
It did say that.
There
and
may
it,
be. Huh?
Yes, and it asked if that would affect the weight or the credibility that that prospective juror would give to that victim, or sorry, that witness. And that question worked. Prospective jurors were able to fill out on several lines following the question any ideas they had or issues with that particular topic. And the court followed up. And this was not a case, I might add, where race was at issue. Race was not a divisive issue in this case. Although appellant is black and his victims were white, the two of the main prosecution witnesses were also black. And appellant's defense was that these young men who were black framed him. This was not a racially charged crime. It was motivated by greed.
I heard you say that the court followed up. Would you elaborate on that?
Yes, the court would ask if the court and the parties went over these questionnaires in detail. And the court would follow up on and ask jurors. The trial court would say, I notice you left these questions blank, or I notice you said X as to this question. And the attorneys were, as this court has identified, were invited to submit further inquiries as to each prospective juror on a case-by-case basis. The prosecution did that on two instances. And the court followed up in one of the instances, and in the other instance, he told the prosecutor that it wasn't necessary based on the answer given. So the trial court did follow up in extensively in each instance where there might have been an ambiguity or a missing answer.
Well, not to belabor the point, but as I understand it, in the written questionnaire, the jurors that you've just described it were informed that there may be parties of different races involved here. Would this impact your ability to be fair? Something like that, right? If the juror said no, what follow-up? You say that the court allowed the attorneys with respect to each individual juror to ask follow-up questions, but if the answer were no, how could defense counsel construct some particularized follow-up as opposed to probing the issue more with the entire panel?
Well, if the answer was no, I would submit that the answer is no, and that that counsel had, before jury selection, time to submit additional questions on the issue of race, which counsel did not. And if voir dire commenced and a jury answered no, this is under penalty of perjury on this questionnaire, and I would submit that there was no reason for the defense counsel to think that there was a problem. There was no red flag. The rest of the questionnaire, 24-page questionnaire, might hint at issues that would indirectly bear on race. Membership in clubs or just personal hobbies or other things that might, as the attorneys went over it, raise red flags. And to me, it's apparent from the record that these are seasoned litigators and possibly seasoned death penalty litigators. The fact that they requested no or few follow-up questions and did not submit additional questions to the questionnaire shows that it was extremely effective and thorough. And the crux of appellant's claim is that they were unable to gather enough information to make challenges for cause. Well, that also is belied by the record, because in the guilt phase, defense counsel made 3 challenges for cause. And in the penalty phase, defense counsel made 4 or 5. And in the guilt phase, defense counsel exercised only 14 of its 20 peremptory challenges. In the guilt phase, they exercised all 20. But the record shows that this jury selection was extremely thorough, and there were no complaints by either party. And defense counsel accepted the jury as constituted in both cases, and there is no indication that race or pretrial publicity or any of the other deficiencies alleged by appellant were actual. Unless this court has any further questions, I'm prepared to submit. And let me just say, Your Honor, then, that James Robinson is not on death row because the trial court's jury selection was inadequate or because of the victim impact evidence was overwhelming. He's on death row because of the mountain of damning evidence that showed that he robbed this Subway store and he murdered Brian Berry and James White. It's absolutely overwhelming. And I would ask this court to respectfully request that this court affirm the judgment.
Thank you, Ms. Brody. We'll hear from Ms. Marr by way of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Marr, on the issue of victim impact evidence, your position is that the evidence should not have come in, and you seem to fault the trial court for that, even though there was no objection made. Shouldn't the focus be on defense counsel in a situation like that, and as opposed to the trial judge, who's, at least as far as I'm concerned, trial judges that allow lawyers to try their own cases without interjecting themselves into the trial, it's a positive trait. So I'm curious as to why the focus isn't on defense counsel's failure to object.
Your Honor, I would not stand before this court and vigorously defend defense counsel's performance in this regard at all. This issue very well may, and I would expect to come before this court on a petition for habeas corpus for ineffective assistance, among other things. However, as we've argued in the briefs, the death penalty in the special context that capital trials and capital penalty phase proceedings occur in imposes some different obligations and some sua sponte, actually, obligations in the trial court to protect the integrity of the judgment and to be sure that the judgment is, that the jurors are not influenced by passion or prejudice and that the death judgment is within the confines of the law, that the jury sentencing decision is.
At what point would you have had the trial court inject itself into this process? And by doing that, doesn't the trial court then place undue emphasis on this material?
Your Honor, I think there are procedures that the trial court could have utilized. It could have asked counsel for an offer of proof, could have asked the prosecutor for an offer of proof as the basic outline of the areas that the parties would testify to, could also have, as we've argued in the briefing, limited some of this. We have at least two of these witnesses talking extensively about their visions of the crime scene and their characterization of the crimes and their characterizations also of what Mr. Robinson was thinking and what their sons were thinking. The jury's heard this, you know, many times, and then the prosecutor argued it very, very heavily in closing argument. So by this time, it's adding up. It's certainly cumulative, and the jury has heard it over and over again, and they're just bombarded with it. If there are any more questions on the victim impact, I can continue with that or respond briefly to Ms. Brody's other points.
I'll leave that to you.
Your Honor, again, we would only state that the defense counsel did see red flags, a few red flags that were able to appear, and pointed them out to the trial court and asked for additional clarification or on some of these points, where the jurors are expressing a bias in favor of the death penalty in cases of premeditated murder or for economic reasons, in their view. And the trial court is not following up. It's unreasonable to expect defense counsel to be able to identify possible issues and point them out to the trial court, where the trial court itself has not followed up on the questions and has not posed terribly clear inquiries in some instances in the questionnaire without the follow-up. Those answers could have been clarified, but were not, because of the trial court's very, very limited questioning on oral voir dire. And finally, the court didn't give these jurors enough time to fill out these forms, and the instructions on the cover sheet of the form, even in the court's remarks, indicate that we need to get this done quickly. We will follow up with you. You'll have a chance to clarify these things. And if voir dire, oral voir dire is to be meaningful and to be meaningfully conducted by the trial court, it's difficult to see how merely repeating the questionnaire inquiries in open court is going to clarify an ambiguous response if it wasn't clear the first time. Finally, Your Honor, I would like to request something from the court on, with respect to the first issue, the first third-party culpability claims. As the court is aware, appellant has raised in the opening brief in Argument 1 claims that the trial court improperly excluded proffered defense evidence of third-party culpability as it pertains to evidence concerning the state's two primary witnesses, Ty Williams and Tommy Aldridge. The evidence that the defense wanted to introduce also was highly relevant to those witnesses' credibility. The United States Supreme Court has, as of last week, granted certiorari in a case, Holmes v. South Carolina, which deals exactly with, on issue two, it deals with these issues that we have raised. And I would like to request that the court allow 5 days for me to submit a supplemental letter brief, given the rarity of a trial of the Supreme Court granting a defense request for certiorari.
Well, the granting of certiorari does not signify anything other than interest on the part of the United States Supreme Court in resolving one or more issues raised. If there were to have been a decision in that Holmes case, of course, that would be a basis for allowing both sides to file supplemental briefing, but the court normally does not vacate submission to allow additional briefing, and I don't think that doing so merely because of the grant of certiorari would be appropriate.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I appreciate your having called that to our attention, and we'll note the significance, if any, of that action by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Thank you, Your Honor. If there are no further questions.
All right. Apparently none. Thank you, Ms. Marr. Thank you, Ms. Brody. The matter stands submitted.